welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM with Padre Greedy and with me, Richard Sanderson. Little Atoms, as I'm sure you know, is an hour-long discussion show revolving around politics and rationalism. We're delighted to welcome back to Resonance FM David Aronovich, who appeared on the show 16 months ago. David is a journalist, a broadcaster and an author. He writes a regular column for The Times, and recently, in the eyes of some, went some way towards correcting an imbalance with a TV programme called No Excuses for Terror. On his last appearance on Little Atoms, over a broad-ranging discussion, David managed to, if not exactly change my mind, then to rethink some of my opinions. This, I'm sure you'll agree, is a pretty good reason for welcoming David Aronovich back onto Little Atoms. David, welcome back.
Hi there.
And, I've written down a sort of almost a spreadsheet of various things I wanted to talk about. But I was thinking about the 16 months that have passed since you were last on the programme. And at that point, one of the first things that occurred to me was that I was pretty much expecting Blair to be gone fairly soon. I certainly thought he wouldn't be here by this point. And the other one was that Michael Howard was the leader of the Conservatives, which now seems an astonishingly long time ago. Are you surprised that Blair's still here?
If I say no, I'm not surprised. Do you promise me you're not going to replay something from 16 months ago, which I said, no, he'll be gone, I'll give him a week? I mean, for a long time, I thought that he would go this summer. Mm-hmm. And I think I probably thought that then. Mm. As Harold Wilson apparently always used to say, so it proved. And we haven't quite got there yet, but nevertheless, that was kind of a fairly settled thing. And one of the problems that one always has in journalism is, if you like, the kind of excitement, and the combination of excitement and a slight herd mentality can have everybody reaching for the moment that he's going to go before and will he be forced out and so on. Of course, there were lots of things along the way, not least the cash for honours question.
There has been some extraordinary feeding frenzies recently, and then they sort of get blocked out by other events and then come sort of rushing back again.
No, it's really interesting to see the Get Gordon feeding frenzy. It's not quite a feeding frenzy because it doesn't have a very specific focus and so on, but nevertheless, it represents a kind of suggestion that not only are we fed up with Tony Blair, but actually we're preemptively fed up with Gordon Brown. And that's actually very ominous, because it seems to suggest that a lot of people aren't going to give him any time at all when he gets in. You can normally expect a bit.
What do you think is the motivation behind this? Because it does seem to have built very, very suddenly. It's like someone has decided for us, we don't like Gordon Brown now, as opposed to when 2 years ago he was fine. Where did this come from?
It is, but it's not just a kind of press thing. It sits out there in the ether. I mean, when the BBC were having their post-budget programmes and having the emails that came in, what astonished me was the uniform and complete hostility of all of them. And I tried to account for this. I mean, you know, the first thing you ask yourself is, David, are you so out of touch with the way in which people are at the moment that you can't see just how exasperated people are? I mean, there's a problem for me there, which is that looking at, if you like, the general statistics, the economic statistics, the statistics of well-being and so on, the government's up there. It's done extraordinarily well compared with almost any government in post-history. So there wouldn't be a reason in that sense, I can't think of, for people to suddenly say, not only are we a bit fed up with you, but actually we're totally pissed off with you. We think you're the lousiest government in the history of governments, and will you please go away? So I hadn't quite expected that. So there's an element of that. The other element of it is what you call the kind of Steve McLaren element. The way it's almost a sort of interconnection maybe that exists. I was thinking about writing about this week. This interconnection that exists between media emphasis and the way in which people respond. I'm not quite sure totally which way around it is. It may be that an edge of opinion is found which justifies the journalism, or vice versa. And before the Israel match, there was this is a program, it might have been Five Live, and there was one of the BBC sports correspondents talking about the forthcoming Israel match and so on. But what was interesting to me was that the tones of exasperation within which this person talked about Steve McLaren were extraordinary. I mean, we hadn't had the match. We were just coming up to now. There was a time where a sports correspondent for the BBC would be saying, "Well, Steve McLaren's saying this, and we think his tactics are going to be that, and obviously a win would be a very good idea, and so on." But this is the record that Israel have been having at home, and so on. This is the kind of scale of the problem, and these are some of the decisions you have to make. But no, and it wasn't just no. That's not the way they did it. The bloke was cross before a ball had been kicked. He was angry with McLaren before McLaren had done a damn thing. It was, well, he told us this, but we've heard all this before. And I thought, why are you so angry? All you've got to do is watch the bloody match. You're only the BBC sports correspondent. It's not as if it's any kind of big skin off your nose one way or the other. But it was like, it's a personal thing. Come forward, you get then the response to Israel, and you get the tabloid response. Come forward to the Barcelona match, and you get a slagging off of the manager before the game has even begun. And you say, where did that begin? Who did it begin with? Did it begin with the fans? Did it begin with the journalists? Is it some kind of nexus in between them? And there's a kind of, I don't know, there's something going on at the moment which I want to try and capture.
Yeah, there seems almost to be sort of a maelstrom of things that sort of catch things up, and I don't know what the word is, but one thing seems to, it's like, almost like a chain reaction of things going on. You used a nice phrase, actually, in one of your recent articles, which was... which sort of relates to this. You're talking about self-indulgent catastrophism, which I like very much. And this is again something a bit of a recurring theme in your some of your columns.
You've been getting boring about it.
Has been about disillusionment, but I think it's a very interesting point. I mean, you just pointed out, you know, economically and in a lot of other ways as well, the UK is in a pretty good shape at the moment, and yet. If you speak to just about anybody, and this is pretty much across the board politically, you'd think we were sliding into absolute chaos.
The chaos or fascism. Those who don't think it's chaos think it's fascism. I suppose it's actually quite hard to believe it's both. But I guess you'd get some takers, maybe people who don't quite sure what chaos is or what fascism is, would think it was both. It's true. There are all kinds of, again, I mean, there's the sort of, you know, there's the surface element of it. It can occur anywhere. Last year in the borough that I live in, Camden, which was a well-run borough, not, you know, council made mistakes and so on, they turfed the council out on the basis of a kind of feeling of crossness about parking wardens. Okay, now you've got the Tory Liberal Democrat alliance in, and surprise, surprise. They get rid of the contract for clamping, which may or may not have been a good contract, and the net result is that they have to begin to cut down on all kinds of community organisations whose focus is solely on the poor. And it's absolutely inevitable. The richer part of the borough essentially turfed the council out on the basis of it couldn't park where it wanted, and the poorer part of the borough, the poorest part of the borough gets the services cut as a result by that council. And all these kind of jolly lefties who voted for the Lib Dems this time, etc., okay, you know, get... I doubt if they even noticed... Because, you know, in a way, that's part of the problem. What you have is a sort of quasi-middle-class revolt. It all reminds me a little bit of the mood at the time, not quite so focused, at the time of the fuel protests. You know, it's a kind of pointless insurrection and insurgency. It's an insurgency of victimhood on part of people who don't suffer. And there is nothing to me which is more intolerable than people who don't suffer whinging about how terrible their lives are.
Well, yes, and I think the motoring lobby, if you want, is a great example of that in a lot of respects. I mean, these are people who are lucky enough to drive cars to start with. But it seems to me more pervasive than that. I mean, it really does seem to me as if people have actually completely lost touch with reality. It seems to me that they have absolutely no concept of what it's actually like in this country at the moment.
Well, there's a real problem for us, isn't there? Because if we're the only two who haven't lost touch with reality, it makes you begin to wonder quite what reality was, and you always have to kind of ask
yourself.
Well,
yes, maybe I'll get lots of emails saying that.
Well, here's the next theme which you get to. Is there something underlying there which is either causing significant levels of anxiety, significant levels, you know, is the pace of change in the world so great, people's relationship, let's say, to their work or to their relationship so anxious that they're looking at for a focus for that anxiety in some sense or other, in other words, a series of kind of inchoate fears. Let's look at the last couple of years. In the nearly 3 years now since accession, we've had 500,000 Polish and other people come to live in the United Kingdom. Now, from my point of view, this is no problem at all. Not only is it no problem at all, but I'm pretty sure that one of the reasons why we're as wealthy as we are is because people are allowed, essentially, to employ people from other EU countries to come here and so on. But it does lead to change. It does lead to a rapidity of changes, and not just in, say, places like Dagenham and so on. But if you go into a large number of places, all of a sudden all these Polish shops are opening up and so on. You hear Polish spoken everywhere. Fine. It would be much more of a problem, and I don't say this because I would feel a problem, but it would be much more of a problem if it were 500,000 Somalis. In that case, we would be having a much more kind of difficult conversation. But I give it as an example of how things have changed with immense rapidity. It may be that people don't feel certain about their jobs, and certainly they demand an awful lot more than they did. One of the big problems with the public services is that people's demands of what a public service should be are completely different from what they were 20 years ago. My mother died the year before last. When the doctor used to come round on her on the rounds, if the doctor looked busy, my mother wouldn't ask how she, my mother, was, because she was afraid to bother the doctor. Now, I would never look at life like that. Mm. I'm going to bother the bloody doctor about how I am and so on, and I think a lot of other people are too. It's a tiny kind of, you know, you might say almost kind of insignificant way, but in a way it's a way in which things change. We don't accept the things that we used to do. And then on the other side of it, there's this incredible kind of thing about how we're all being spied on. You know, and we really are, you know. You cannot use the word schizophrenic, by the way, to say you have a divided self about these things, because that's apparently the wrong
term, schizophrenic.
So, and it is. But it is certainly true that we can look at the same phenomenon with two entirely different sets of eyes. CCTV being the classic example. CCTV is at one and the same time considered to be this kind of an example of the intrusion on all our lives. And the second thing is that as soon as anything happens in any locality, they all call for CCTV to be put in. And that's just kind of one example of the lack of sureness that we have about which direction we want to go in sometimes.
I'm wondering...
Airport security, where everyone complains constantly about having to go through so many checks, and then if the slightest thing does get through, there's a huge panic.
Some sent a journalist down, and it's a front page, everybody says, tss, they are careless, but don't search me! Yeah. It's absolutely true. I mean, and these kind of penalties of modern living, which people find increasingly noisome. Now, if like me, and I know that you're a smoker, Padraig, but if like me, you're sort of not a smoker and so on, the July can't come fast enough.
Can't come fast enough for me, to be honest.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, but having been a smoker a long time ago myself, and I kind of remember what it's like. I do watch all these people now, smokers, forced to go out and stand on the pavements in the, I wouldn't be at all surprised if they wouldn't quite like to take a lump out of somebody for that, even if they do think it's their own fault. In a kind of, you know, I'm not suggesting that people say, I'm going to vote, I hate Tony Blair because he forces me to stand outside. But if you're kind of configuring the world as a world in which people keep interfering with your freedoms and so on, it's possible that that's kind of... And when they had this campaign against road pricing and so on, it was mad paranoia. Actually, it was absolutely nothing to do with
what had been suggested. Oh, the million signatures.
And my wife got one from her cousin, Jane, and I wrote about it. The cousin, Jane, was extremely cross, and so on. But it was an absolute classic. There they are, living out in Wiltshire and so on, extremely comfortably and so on, with not a vast amount to do and so on. It's very, very nice people and so on. And all of a sudden, the one thing she starts campaigning about, like Billio, is the fact that somebody might, although they probably won't, charge her to drive on congested roads.
I'm wondering whether some of this is a problem of our own making, partly because of things like we now give ourselves targets for everything, and often we don't hit them. So, A, that's a problem. And secondly, this is kind of an internet thing, and a classic example would be the Guardian's comment is free thing, where, you know, you're absolutely encouraged to get online and complain about things all the time, which perhaps gives us, if we were to, you know, I mean, if I was to discuss that, for example, you'd get the impression that most of the readers of the Guardian are pretty bonkers, and in fact they're just the people who can be bothered to write in. So maybe A, we're slightly getting this out of perspective, and B, we're kind of encouraging people to do it anyway.
Now, you have a good point here, because the other thing that I did wonder about the BBC response to the Chancellor's budget were maybe the people who do this kind of stuff and making this kind of comment are just the people who moan most. Yeah. I mean, apparently there's a marvellous confrontation between Guido Fawkes and Michael White from last night's Newsnight, which you can find online, in which Michael White, I mean, takes Guido Fawkes to the cleaners. People have said, you know, you look at this website because it has interesting stuff on it. I have, and it's utter shite. It's shite of the most complete sort. It's shite in commentary. But what's more to the point, you know, maybe he has found something out, but I've never actually located him in finding something out. But the comments section, which is most of it, is just abuse. It's abuse from beginning to end. They're all abusing the same person, because they're all abusing Labour and so on. So they all end up abusing, or Nick Robinson at the BBC, and I kind of cut a couple of targets. And I think, this is pointless. This is, you know, and comments is free can sometimes get a bit like that, because the same people come round. And once you work that out, and you can see also that it's thinning out the other commentaries. The other people are beginning to fall by the wayside. Yeah. The other, maybe some of the more interesting people, something they just think, I just can't be arsed with this. I just get kind of lost in this.
I've given up on it. I mean, really, it's. I wish there was an option where you could just read the article, so I don't get tempted to read down.
There is an option. Uh-huh. But it goes against the spirit of the internet. And the option is to moderate out stupid comments. Now, it's very, very time-consuming to do that. And also, some people would say, you know, you're effectively censoring. Mm. Good. One of the things that you learn as a chair of a meeting is that everybody in a particular meeting might want people to get their fair say, but they don't want everybody to be able to say whatever they want whenever they want to say it, because they would like to get home at some kind of point, and
indeed,
not every contribution is equally valuable. And when you chair meetings, you're very, very aware of the balance that you strike there between getting people to have their say and not getting everybody, because not everybody everybody doesn't want to hear what everybody else has got to say, and that's not because they're fascists, it's because quite a lot of what some people say is rubbish.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure Padraig will recognise this as well, because you know, in the humanist scene, there's always at every meeting there's a couple of people with particularly strong agendas who will stand up at every meeting. And if you've got a good chair, they'll silence them pretty quickly, but otherwise you are going to be there all evening.
Really. Yeah, so absolutely.
Your population control people will always turn up. They're fantastic.
Is that right?
There was a funny incident on Sunday. We Neil, the co-presenter of Little Atoms, and I went to a meeting in Oxford with at Oxford Literary Festival with Chris Richens and Nick Cullen. And as we came out, there was a man standing there very irately, laying into, there's no other term for it, laying into the chair, saying, you deliberately chose people who agreed with the speakers. And the obvious answer is, how the hell do I know whether they agreed to speak? Not the random people in the crowd putting their hands up. And eventually he managed to, this chap managed to corner Hitchens and went into an anti-Semitic rant about the meeting had nothing to do with Palestine or Israel or the Ottoman Empire or anything, but we had
everything
has to do with Israel.
You know, I've now got used to the fact that you can write about the water rates, and the first comment says, yeah, but what about you and Israel? it's creepy, really. So I'm not that surprised by it.
It is, Ross. It can be scary.
So I am just wondering, though, whether maybe we've got things out of proportion, and in fact, as I'm saying, it is the louder speakers that are getting heard, and perhaps Britain isn't this seething cauldron of resentment that perhaps you get the impression it is by reading both The Guardian and The Mail.
Well, it's worth it's worth remembering, I suppose, that probably within the polls you'll find of those people, you know, people saying Blair's doing a good job, maybe there's 30% who think that. That 30% is not only underrepresented on the media, it is unrepresented on the media. You know, apart from, say, me and Steve Richards and so on, there's not anybody likely to be saying that such people even exist. It's inconceivable.
I think it's just the nature of journalism and the media at large, that people are very uncomfortable. You know, you get up to write a column and say, well, everything's going fine, carry on as you were. It's very hard to do.
Well,
it's getting more and more easier to snipe.
You have a good point. I mean, in a sense, I can keep in the fight, because the thing that I dislike, the two things, I mean, you know, I've thought a lot about why I say what I do and what makes me go there. The thing I loathe two things. Firstly, I loathe populism. I hate it. I hate it as a political force. I hate it. Almost always goes together with having a scapegoat. It almost always goes together with these three words, which you hear as I don't care. And if you don't care, then in that case we're not going to have a discussion. So it's going to be really it's going to be really hard. So it's kind of antithetical to internet. I think it's all rare or very dangerous. And also there's something just psychologically that doesn't suit me about it. I don't like it. I don't like the way in which people, like this BBC reporter McLaramack. He's just a populist. He's just playing to the gallery and so on. And he's doing it at somebody else's expense, and it drives me crazy. Because I can quite easily imagine that it's me that somebody's doing that to. I have no kind of difficulty. But the second thing is, which is what you might call sort of conventional journalistic orthodoxies. And the speed with which they are adopted and become encrusted is staggering. We have an extraordinarily diverse media. All kinds of outlets and so on. But what is amazing is how it's almost like kind of Richard Dawkins' notion of the viral meme, isn't it? The mimetic notion, the idea, the mind virus. Sometimes it's almost like that. Everybody gets it, or almost everybody gets the same virus at the same bloody time. They've all got the same political flu simultaneously. But they all choose to cough and splutter and hack and it's a shame.
Can you give us an example of that? An example
would actually be the Gordon Brown budget. We all know what the Gordon Brown budget is supposed to be, without even if we've not read any of the Gordon Brown budget. He took away with one hand and he gave with the other, and can sort of name the kind of three main things. But let's take another absolute classic, since it's an absolute classic. Tony Blair lied about WMD. Mm-hmm. You can find Simon Jenkins saying it as a fact in his column. It's not a fact. It's not a fact at all. I mean, it's not only it's just not a fact because Hutton says it's not a fact and the Butler Committee doesn't say it's a fact, but if you look at the stuff in the evidence that was given up for Butler, it's not a fact. It's not true. Yeah. Now, you can say the fact that he was as wrong in the way he was should have meant him going. That's a perfectly fair argument. You can make that argument, you can make an argument against. But the notion of Blair as a liar over WMD is now absolutely everywhere. And you're almost permitted to say it journalistically, kind of almost anywhere. Yeah. It's taken off from from Min Campbell's thing, a false prospectus. And let us not remember, above all, that when Min Campbell was presented with the dossier, his first words in Parliament was, "This tells us nothing that we didn't already know or assume." Would you guess that was Min Campbell's first words from everything subsequent? I don't think so.
Well, David, I'd quite like to move on a little bit now, and it connects a little bit to what you were talking about on the BBC just then, and that was I was listening to Radio 5, which I actually quite like. I mean, it has some in-depth discussions. It also has the problems that we kind of identify with blogs, and it's very much sort of the programme's dictated by the amount of people that ring up on a subject. But the other day I did hear somebody desperately preempting it, and I thought it was shameful. He basically said, "Have you got any conspiracy theories? Would you like to share them with us?" And you can imagine that within moments it was the cliches of the switchboard and meltdown, and I know this is the subject of your new book, which you've just finished writing, and I think what we'll actually do is we'll have a quick break and we'll have some music. And then I'd like to talk about conspiracy theories, because I do think it's a fascinating area, and it's something we haven't covered that much on this show, astonishingly. So we managed to track down the piece of music you requested.
You're a genius. I've been looking for this for ages. And just to say by way of intro, if you don't mind.
Please.
This is a piece that my parents had on a record when I was a kid. And me and my brother, when we were 8 and 6, used to kind of love this. And I haven't heard it probably for 40 years and so on, and I couldn't find it. You have found it.
Well, I really, really hope it's the right thing.
Actually, after that, if it's not the right thing, I'm going to pretend it is.
It's going to be the most devastating disappointment if it isn't. But anyway, it is Melina Mercouri, and it's from the soundtrack of the film Never on a Sunday. Mm-hmm.
όνειρο μου στέλνα ένα, δύο και τρία και τέσσερα φιλιά. Που φτάνουν στο λιμάνι ένα και δύο και τρία και τέσσερα πουλιά. Που στα σελάρα έχω ένα και δύο και τρία και τέσσερα παιδιά. Θα μεγαλώσουν όλα να γίνουν λεβέντες για χάρη του Πειραιά. Όσο κι αν ψάξω δεν βρίσκω άλλο λιμάνι. Τρελή να μ' έχει κάνει όσο το Πειραιά. Όταν βραδιάζει τραγούδια μάρα δεία τις παιδιάς του αλλάζει, γεμίζει από παιδιά. Το μου σαβγό δεν υπάρχει κανείς που να μην τον αγαπώ. Και σαν το βράδυ κοιμηθώ, ξέρω πως, ξέρω πως, πως θα τον ονειρευτώ. Μετά διαβάζω στο λαιμό και μια χάει και μια χάει και μια χάντρα φυλαχτώ. Γιατί το βράδυ κάθε εγώ στο λιμάνι σαβγό κάποιον άγνωστο να βάρω. Όσο κι αν ψάξω δεν βρίσκω άλλο λιμάνι. Τρελή να μ' έχει κάνει όσο το Πειραιά. Όταν βραδιάζει τραγούδια μάρα διάζει και τις παινιές του αλλάζει γεμίζει από παιδί.
Welcome back to Little Atoms with me, Richard Sanderson, with Padre Greedy and our guest David Aronovich. And we're just, well, that was the sound of Melina Mercouri. Did it bring back...
Oh, no, that was absolutely fantastic. I can't tell you. It's a really kind of... she obviously subsequently became Minister of Culture in the post-fascist government. My parents, and I, one of the first political activities I did was to collect money for Greek political prisoners outside the film Zed. The music was by Theodorakis and so on. And Melina Mercouri was a kind of, you know, a great figure who then, after the fascists were kicked out, subsequently became Minister of Culture in the Papandreou government.
I had no idea about that.
Yeah, and she was also, Padre, a great smoker. Oh. And you can tell that in the voice. And it was just wonderful hearing that again.
So just before we heard that, and I'm incredibly relieved it was the right one. Just before we heard that, we were talking about the conspiracy theories, which is subject of your new book, which will be out, we know not when, but you've actually finished writing it and it's gone off to the publishers.
Yeah, when you say new book, I think people should be aware that I sent them the conclusion on Monday morning. So this is new, as in, you know, this really is new.
Yeah,
and it's a long way from publication.
So
we'll just repeat the programme closer to publication.
And that's the only safe thing to do.
What made you think that this is something that a book should be written about?
I'm not at all sure it should, actually. I'm not at all sure it should have been written by me, given that it's taken me 3 years. in the first place, I mean, I was just fascinated by why it is people decide to believe the things they do, why they want to believe the things they do. I mean, to take a tiny example, which is from the book, if you get a book like The Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which is a victimless conspiracy theory, unless, you know,
this is the one that was recently in court with Dan Brown.
Oh, Dan Brown, that's right. Essentially, claims to have discovered the bloodline of Christ in the Merovingians and so on. And was actually, you know, grew out of a series of BBC Chronicle programmes, which were supposedly historical. The book is, somebody called it delirious, and I think that's broadly true, and the whole series of books after it, but the thing also, it's incredibly boring. And it's full of kind of lists and sort of arcana and so on. It sold 2 million copies. Mm-hmm. There isn't a history book, no matter how brilliantly written, that has come, a really decent history book by a fantastic writing historian, that has come close to that level of sales. Why do we prefer the bollocks to the you know? So that became, in some ways, a kind of question that I wanted to answer. What is it about us? And also, but I wanted also to look at the bigger ones, the ones that actually had caused people a lot of trouble. Obviously, so I start off with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, mm-hmm. The forgery, which was created sometime at the right at the end of the 19th century, and then imported into Russia before the revolution, but really took off after the First World War.
Do we know why it was written in the first place?
It was a nasty
bit of propaganda.
No, it was. It was at a time, I mean, part of it was at a time when there was some liberalism going on in Tsarist Russia, and it was partially written to kind of get a reaction to the Jews and to possible Jewish backers of this reform process in Russia, and to shore up the Tsar and the monarchy. So that was part of the impulse which was behind it. And, you know, there's a whole kind of detective story behind how it was presented and what it arose from, and the original documents, you kind of going back. But this stuff is hugely believed just after the First World War. It's believed by Henry Ford, who publishes it in his newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, Henry Ford, the great car maker. And obviously it becomes fairly widely believed in Germany, most ominously, in the period before and during the Nazi seizure of power, and is widely believed in the Middle East now. That's a kind of kickoff. But I've also looked at others, like there's a state conspiracy theory that the great Trotskyite conspiracy, which Stalin and his henchmen said was happening, which was also widely believed by sections of the left as being true, that Trotsky and his out of favour compatriots, including a lot in the higher echelons of the Bolshevik Party, had not only plotted against Stalin, but that wouldn't be anything like sufficient. They'd actually been responsible for sabotaging large sections of Soviet industry, the Soviet industry they themselves were supposedly trying to build up, and also doing it in cahoots with the Japanese and Rudolf Hess and every kind of, you know, in other words, a kind of classic, again, delirious conspiracy. Not only is your opponent wrong, but he's actually in league effectively with the devil. And then right the way up to 9/11 conspiracy theories. It is astonishing, you know, what purchase some of these theories have. And actually, in the era of the internet, it's amazing what kinds of strange alliances, because in the past, political structures and so on, you, on the whole, people would have to meet up in order to, at the very least, they'd have to buy the same book or something like that, and then meet up in order to have a kind of a structured discussion and so on, and put themselves on the same side. Now, you don't need to do that at all. You just need a website and a virus, essentially, a kind of mind. Again, we're talking about a kind of mind virus, and you can get people coming together who have no notion about what each other's other interests are. And there are some really ominous little kind of alliances.
And it seems to me that, oddly enough, it's the really big ones that really catch on, rather than, because I'm thinking about, well, there are conspiracies, there have been conspiracies. I mean, Watergate comes to mind. It's a pretty big conspiracy.
Watergate's not a very big conspiracy. Watergate is a burglary, which is then covered up. you know, as conspiracies go.
Well, burglary it's not very you know, at the end of the day was.
No, it's not. But it's not a very complicated thing, is it?
Okay.
You know, it's not running the world. It's let's go from burgle the Democrats and find out any shit that we've got on them. Okay, but it's a burglary which you then cover up. That is not a big kind of, you know, to do that. And even then they fuck it up. Sorry, am I allowed to say that?
No.
Even then they bugger it up. Can I say that?
No.
Yes. Even then they mess it up. Okay.
That'll have to do.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I won't do that again.
But still, I mean, it is interesting that, yes, it's the big ones, and I suppose the 9/11 one is the huge one at the moment.
We don't get much bigger than that, do you?
And it's certainly, you know, it's been covered on this station, I know, on other programmes. The 9/11 one is bizarre in, well, in so many ways, but it's interesting because it does seem to be politically supported on right across the spectrum as well.
Right across the spectrum, it's supported on sections of the left and sections of the right. But it is certainly true that it's, you know, I mean, there are people who kind of dive into it and out of it who actually aren't deeply political in any sense whatsoever. But by and large, the people who would be likely to believe it are those opponents of Bush who hate Bush and who think Bush is capable of anything on the left. Quite a wide spectrum and a fairly narrow spectrum on the far right, is broadly. What is amazing is that they don't understand each other at all. They don't know who each other are. I think the right does, but some of the people on the left have no notion at all. It's like the stuff about, you know, the Jewish lobby and so on. They have no notion at all about what these people are about. It's like some people looking at the BNP now have no idea where Nick Griffin came from and the racial nature of his politics and his kind of history of anti-Semitism. They just don't get it, you know, because political formations which might have kind of helped instruct them, like trades unions and so on, have declined in power. There's no kind of transmission of information there, even at the kind of crudest level. And so it's very difficult to tell people, oh, hold on a second. You know, have you seen what this guy Eric Hufschmidt actually believes? Have you seen this stuff about crypto? He accuses other people of being crypto Jews. And this is an accusation. You know, it's not, if you call somebody a crypto Jew, the worst thing you can call them. It's kind of, you know, straight back to kind of, you know, holiday time at the old SS camp.
It's absolutely terrifying. And I suppose that, to me, the most terrifying thing about the conspiracy theories, apart from the fact that, you know, you've now got these sort of staggering figures of the amount of people in America who think there's something up with 9/11. I mean, I'm quite sure all of them don't go for the Shayla line, who has a programme, incidentally, about an hour and a half after us on this station.
What is?
David Shayla has a programme on this
Does
stage.
Does he?
Yeah.
Well, David Shayla of their holograms.
Their holograms,
that's right.
Yeah.
Somehow or other they managed to not have planes, but holograms of planes.
Oh, he stopped, I'm told. Oh, well, that's good news.
Did he stop, or was he
but, well, that's what everybody's asking Ellie Machen, isn't
it? But yes, I mean, what I'm saying is that not everybody that I suggest suggests that they're interested in that theory are going for the hologram.
No, but in a way, actually, funny enough, that's the most honest position, because what quite a lot of modern conspiracists go for is the kind of disturbing questions approach, which is to say, we don't necessarily support a conspiracy theory, but the official version is obviously wrong. Now, unfortunately, something caused the twins. It's like the David Kelly death. It's like this Norman Baker MP. As far as I can tell, if Norman Baker is right about what didn't kill David Kelly is the Lib Dem, then there's only one answer, which is David Kelly's still alive, because nothing killed him. You know, it's a kind of, you know, it's an absurd position. And they said, we're just asking, these kind of questions. Well, they're not actually. The questions they ask actually provoke the conspiracy theory. They can't be provocative of anything else.
Yeah. I think this leads us back to what you were mentioning earlier. People don't, maybe there isn't a clear political grounding anymore. And in the same way, perhaps there isn't a need to provide any kind of a program or a solution anymore. It's enough to raise an eyebrow and say, well, is it really? I'm asking the difficult questions, therefore I have actually done something. That seems to be happening a lot at the moment.
I think the people who believe that actually do believe a theory. Mm-hmm. But they're just rather embarrassed about it, because when you start kind of picking it apart, like the controlled demolitions in the World Trade Center, you know, which not only, I mean, quite apart from anything else, you control demolish the World Trade Center, but you have to fly the planes into the exact spot. You know, this is a government that cannot fake WMD fines in the Iraqi desert. Okay, which compared with any of this would be you'd have thought simplicity itself. What could be easier? If you can arrange to have the two major planes fly, or holograms even, fly into the world in exactly the spot where you've got your controlled demolition set off, etc., you'd have thought that taking a whole lot of anthrax and sticking it somewhere in Anbar would be a cinch, wouldn't you? But no.
Look what we found.
Yeah, exactly.
Mind, of course, if they do now, that would be what everybody will say.
Of course, everybody will say, but they didn't, you know.
It's a very good point.
Anyway, so you get this. So something like David Ray Griffin, who's known as the kind of dean of 9/11 conspiracism, this American theologian from the very comfortable Californian town of Claremont, east of Los Angeles, you know, retires from being the professor of theology one day and becomes a 9/11 theorist the next. He takes upon him the mantle of being able to make judgments between a tiny number of maverick scientists on the one hand and almost every engineer in the United States on the other, and can decide that every other engineer in the United States is wrong. You know, and in the book I kind of speculate about what would happen if the editor of Popular Mechanics took it upon himself to kind of write critiques of David Ray Griffin's theology, you know. Whether he would say, oh yes, that's a perfectly fair, I'll go for that. I mean, it's complete, you know, the fact is it's nonsense, but a lot of people want it in some level or another. They kind of they desire it. And right. Towards the end, well, that's what I come at different things at different times, but I think that one of the reasons is that if you believe, one of the greatest fears that we have is actually of chaos. If you believe that somebody planned it all, there isn't chaos. There's order. And it implies, and that order implies two things. Firstly, that we're not on our own in some kind of a way. And secondly, that you could, if you were optimistic, have a reverse conspiracy which set things to rights. You know, in other words, it's about the kind of perfectibility of real life. And the second aspect of it is almost a kind of psychoanalytical level, and I go into this a little bit towards the end. If you look at people who are paranoid and so on, one of the reasons quite often they're paranoid, you take elderly people who tend very much to be paranoid, they're at their most paranoid when nobody cares about them. In other words, believing people are out to get you is actually a defence against indifference, in a funny sort of a way, because actually the terrible truth is, for some people, a lot of people, nobody really cares about them. And that's an intolerable thing. And I see in Norman Baker the classic example of somebody who wants to be cared about and nobody cares about him because he's a twat.
Probably not allowed to say that either.
I was not allowed to say that.
I'd forgotten that your last appearance on the show, I think, it scored quite highly on the swearometer. But
what's the point of not being the BBC if you can't?
So while we're on the subject of paranoid conspiracy theorists, Iran is looking a bit tricky lately, and headed by a man who has all the appearance of a paranoid conspiracy theorist. And similarly, maybe, what we're seeing in the past few days, is that a similar cry for attention of what's happening?
It's actually very difficult. I mean, I don't know what the calculation... I mean, it's very hard to believe that they didn't... Either it was a local decision, and the local commander just kind of looking for British people, you know, and thought actually that was on their side of the water and didn't know, because their GPS is actually complete crap compared with our wonderful new spanking new GPS, which is possible. Or you believe that Tehran put its orders out to the local commanders, look, it wouldn't do us any harm at the moment to nab another few of those Brits like what we did back in 2004 so that we can have something to play with. There's kind of, we tend to have kind of two notions about the Iranians. We have obviously lots of, first is that they're fiendishly clever, and the other one is that they're so ideologically bonkers that they don't know what they're doing and so on. And I suppose both things can be kind of loosely true, but what is also very likely in their case is that they make miscalculations. I was looking at Craig Murray as a suggestion that actually the Iranians were quite right, and that was immediately played on Iraqi, it was relayed by Iraqi news agency. And I thought Iranian news agency. And I thought it's quite possible that they believe that somebody like Craig Murray represents the true response to Blair and actually the true response of the British people. And I would imagine by now their ambassador is signalling back to Tehran saying, you know, that kind of thing we thought about how, might not be quite how the Brits are responding, might not quite have gone that way. And we're learning all kinds of little lessons out of it, like the, you know, the response of the Russians and the Chinese to the need to get a proper resolution out. Reminds us of the game that Putin is playing at the moment and so on. Now, of course, a large number of listeners to this and in general out there think there's only one major villain in society, that's America. Oh, and if we want to stick Britain up behind that and Israel behind that, that will probably make up our kind of trio. And the events of the last few weeks have been very, very difficult for that mindset, because now we've been reminded of the situation in Zimbabwe, which doesn't really seem to emerge from anything that George Bush has done wrong, quite the reverse. Also about the situation in Darfur, but the way in which the Iranian government acts is a big reminder that we're not kind of dealing here with, you know, just a sort of set of people who are slightly misunderstood. They're a really difficult bunch. Now, that said, they're divided. There are different, as far as, I mean, every expert who seems to know anything about Iran agrees that there are different elements within Tehran. You're never really quite sure which one you're dealing with at any given time. But one of the things we can be reasonably sure about is that that argument that says that being tough with the Iranians is counterproductive is wrong. It's wrong, we know it's wrong, because Ahmadinejad is being criticised by the other forces in Iran for having created a confrontation with the rest of the world. Now, I don't mean by saying that you couldn't actually, by a clumsy response, bring about a worse situation. But what I am saying is that being fairly tough with Tehran has worked and works, and it's got to be understood. And there are a lot of really stupid people, including stupid people in incredibly high places, who think they know a lot, who don't understand, seem to understand this, and don't, because they don't want to read the runes. They don't want to see that in what's going on.
I was reading, I mean, it was actually before this kicked off, but I was reading an article by Noam Chomsky, who's not somebody I go out of my way to read, but he was in the position where he was in the spot in the Guardian where Polly Toynbee normally is,
and he you didn't notice till you got to the end. You know, this is not Polly's usual style. And she hasn't once said, you know, the government's let us down by not saying it's socialist.
And what he was saying was, I actually thought it was quite interesting, and was saying, you know, this is an interesting quote from Chomsky anyway, that he didn't think America was going to attack Iran. That came as a bit of a surprise to me. Seemed fairly underplayed. I would have put that as the headline. And the other one was that he was saying, well, actually, you know, Ahmadinejad, for all his shouting and carrying on, doesn't really call the shots. I don't know the truth of that, but I imagine there's, you know, that we sometimes do exaggerate the importance of Ahmadinejad.
No, I think that's right. I mean, he's quite clearly in a slightly precarious position. But one of the reasons he's in a precarious position is because we're saying we're fed up with him. You know, not because we're saying, oh dear, no, we do like you really, and if you know, actually do what you like to us, and so on. And that's not the reason why he's in trouble with the Supreme Council. But nevertheless, I think there's a lot. I mean, there is a kind of, you know, poor old Melanie, but there is this kind of, you know, there is the kind of Melanie Phillips that wish by everything is a total disaster waiting to happen on the other side, and the only way you can front it down is by a massive response, and anything less than a massive response is treachery and degeneration and so on. But I, like Noam Chomsky in this instance, I don't think that's likely to happen. I mean, you know, Cy Hirsch in the New Yorker has been banging on for ages with his anonymous things about how they're going to attack Iran and so on. I've always thought it was nonsense. I've always thought it was really, really nonsense. It's not until there's actual evidence that they are getting close to a nuclear weapon and there's no chance of getting any kind of deal that we would begin to see any serious talk about what the military options might be.
That's it. Well, I tend to agree with that. I'm a little bit reassured by it. I mean, I'm slightly panicky about how this is going to pan out. I'm I have enough faith in human nature that I think it probably will get sorted out.
Oh, I tell you, one of the dangers, I don't think the dangers comes from an over-American reaction. One of the dangers comes from an under-American reaction inside the next. I mean, we have this kind of ludicrous position whereby the Democrats are trying to prove how hairy-chested they are by saying, we're going to get the troops out no matter what the Iraqis think, no matter what the situation is in Iran. That's desperate. That's desperate. And that's not a progressive position. That's, you know, that's old Douglas Hurd type stuff, except being served up. Now, you know, I can understand, you know, you can understand it to a certain extent, based on kind of popular feelings about the Iraq war, but as a policy, it is totally disgusting. I mean, it's really irresponsible. And I think a large number of the people who voted for it know it.
And isolationist.
Yeah.
Which is something, which is opposed very strongly.
I certainly oppose it.
Well, do you think? I mean, speaking in those terms, we sat around here would very much be internationalists, and I suppose the phrase used is liberal interventionists. Do you think we are in a position now post Iraq where that just doesn't seem an option anymore?
Yeah, we're hugely weakened.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. I mean, it would be kind of idiotic. I mean, you know, not one of us looks at Iraq and say, yeah, that's pretty much what I expected would happen. You know, I mean, every single time you hear that, I mean, just take the last days or so, suicide bombers go into an area of a town, blow it up in order to get the local Shia excited and angry. It succeeds, in they go, and they kill 75 Sunni guys by dragging them out of their house. I couldn't even begin. I mean, you know, I never ever expected that there would be people whose politics were so Hitlerite and degenerate that they would actually see this as a political strategy. What I thought would happen would be that the sort of populace within which they would move around would, seeing the advantage of the other way, would suppress them. It is the biggest example I've ever seen of how a small number of people can destroy things for a large number of people. Mm. I mean, I defy anybody to think of a larger example than that happening at a kind of national scale. You know, how many people support these suicide bombers? Extremely few. You know, George Galloway and a couple of others. Now, I'm sure George doesn't support the guy. You know, he just supports the one without, you know, wearing their sandals, etc. But we actually got here through the insurgency. Yeah. That's how we got to this stage. It was, you know, so those people who supported the insurgency can point the fingers at us. Well, you know, we'll have to take that on the chin and so on. But and actually, in a way, it didn't really matter that they supported the insurgency. The insurgents don't give a toss what George Galloway says, nor should anyone else.
Well, speaking, I mean, of whether people give a toss or not, as an aside, I noticed, I can't remember where the report was on the Iranian situation, and it was either BBC or Guardian that said apparently the main Iranian news station wasn't actually covering this, and the main story on Iranian news two nights ago was CND's anti-Trident campaign in London.
Was it?
Yeah. Clearly, they do. I mean, if you think back to 2003 when Iraqi state TV went absolutely euphoric over the anti-war marches, I think maybe, you know, there may be an arrogance to it, but they are paying attention to what's being said.
No, they do. They do, and they can, you know, and they construct the reality they want out of that situation. I mean, coming back, however, to your big point, which is very interesting, you do ask yourself whether we would have been able to campaign more effectively and got a more effective response on Darfur. I mean, I know this is a charge easily made by people who are against the invasion of Iraq, but just because they make the charge doesn't mean that there's not necessarily a possibility of some truth in it. I just don't know. I know Blair himself thinks a lot about Darfur, and so on, and the difficulties of getting an intervention are absolutely staggering.
Mm-hmm.
And I just say to people, you know, if you really look forward to the day when China is the world leader, just have a look at their record inside the UN. Yeah. It's dire. And we've got to get to the situation somehow or other whereby, if that's going to be another pole of world governance, there is some responsibility assumed by the Chinese for what goes on in the rest of the world.
We're at risk of sounding like the people we were discussing at the beginning of the show, the people that see nothing but gloom and despair everywhere. I'm wondering whether there are any signs of just generally things improving at all. I'm thinking a little bit about your No Excuses for Terror program, which actually seemed to be welcomed more warmly than I perhaps expected.
I think one of the things that we should know is that there are an awful lot of people out there who tend to think the sort of way in which we do, but who don't really have the rub of the green. You know, maybe they're, with the exception of ourselves, of course, the quieter people at the dinner parties, or so the people who don't quite, you know, they're the people who always say they think Tony Blair actually is still, you know, what, 30% are doing a good job. You never hear, you know, you never hear about them, as we're saying at the beginning. And there's a lot of good stuff happening in this country. There's an awful lot, you know, the pace of change is very dramatic, but there's an awful lot of good stuff happening. And you sort of, I kind of feel that in the end, people will be commonsensical about it when it comes to things like elections and so on. And they'll say, yeah, I know, like any kind of saloon bar situation, I've been having a moan and so on. You know, when you stand next to somebody at a football match who's been moaning all the time, etc., and then turns out that, you know, you've won 2-0, he says, oh, he said, well, you know, after moaning all the time, I enjoyed that.
Well, maybe, I mean, I've always thought it's a great English characteristic is that we do actually like a good moan. I think that's it. It's something the English do extraordinarily well.
Whinging palms.
Just got quick time to ask you one last question. Now, I made the mistake last time we were on of taking some information from Wikipedia, which then turned out to be wildly wrong. And your Wikipedia, incidentally, by the way, is sort of changes in size, like an accordion bellows. It seems
well, not
to be,
because of me. I don't touch it.
People seem to be editing it all the time. But I'd need to know this University Challenge story. Yeah. Is it true? Did you go on University Challenge and answer?
That's certainly true.
Do tell us quickly.
And we certainly did go on in order to disrupt it because we were elected at a general meeting. We are talking. I mean.
I think maybe you should fill people in slightly in the background if people don't know the story.
Well,
I was at Manchester University, yeah. And we thought that it was an elitist thing because none of the polys got to go in all these Oxbridge colleges. So you've got about 80 people, so, you know, the chances of representing Oxbridge. And it was true, actually, for God's sake. So we went on and we also forged all kinds of a large number of the guest tickets. And a whole campaign for disinvestment in South Africa turned up and they chanted and that was part of it as well. So it's not quite true as in Wikipedia, but it's broadly true.
And did you answer every single question with the name of a revolutionary?
No, we did.
Oh, what a shame.
And then I got really, really and then I started answering questions because I wanted the points. That's how competitive I am.
Well, David Aronovich, it's been a great pleasure having you on again. I dare say when the book's out, we maybe ask you on again, but it's been fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank
indeed.
You.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. We do have a website, littleatoms.com, where you can write in and abuse us, I suppose. Thanks for listening.